Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight on The Big Show, one of our favorite actors. He has three films in release this season, City of Ember, Frost Nixon, and Oliver Stone's W, Mr. Toby Jones. We'll also be paying tribute to the late, great actor Paul Newman. And speaking with the screenwriter of the new film that comes out this Friday, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, Miss Loreen Scafaria. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Now about to enter the portals of Movie Geek Heaven.
Is that what we're calling tonight? Cool.
Yeah, that's the theme of tonight's show. We are your hosts. My name is Jamie, and
my name is Jerry. Welcome to our show. We're delighted to have you.
Very good. this is going to be a great one, man.
This is going to be enormous.
I've been really looking forward to this one. How have you been? How are things going with you since... Oh, 2 days ago.
Just, you know, working, that sort of stuff, working. I've had my, we've had our ups and downs here, but I think everything's all right now. But I'm looking forward to the Toby Jones interview, and I'm looking forward to talking with the screenwriter of Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, and, of course, talking about Paul Newman.
Yeah. So I'm really excited about this movie season. I always am when the fall comes around because it's the mark of real great quality films, the closer you get to Oscars, obviously. But man, the lineup of films this fall just look very good to me.
It's staggering, though, the amount, though. I am kind of shocked. We're looking like four or five major releases a weekend from here on out. It's insane.
Yeah, it really is. It really is kind of overloaded. But our favorite filmmakers are working.
Yeah, that's the big thing. I mean, some of our favorites are definitely, and looks like they're back in top form, to say the least.
Yeah. So there's reason to rejoice, and there's definite reason to keep listening in to Movie Geeks United for the rest of the season. We have some great
Well, they should
shows.
Always listen, regardless of whatever is going on in the theater. They should always listen.
Yeah, that's true. There's some great shows upcoming. We have a great guest on Sunday's show. We have one of the screenwriters of the new film, An American Carol. I don't know if anyone's seen anything from this film. It's the David Zucker directed, it's kind of a conservative satire. Not a satire about conservatives, but a satire from a conservative point of view. I suppose you would classify it as that. And we're following up that interview with another interview with the director of a new documentary on Larry Flint. So I think that's going to be a fascinating show.
Oh, that's going to be you get both ends of the spectrum with that one. There's no doubt about that. I saw an interview with Zucker on MSNBC earlier.
Yeah.
He felt he looked very uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. And then we have talents like director James Gunn. We're trying to book the composer of W. It's a film that we're really looking forward to, and I just heard that he just finished the score for W on Saturday night, this past Saturday.
Wow!
So this movie is literally, you know, hot off the press. I think this is a real rush to get this film done, and by all accounts, by looking at the trailer, it seems to have that real urgency.
It does. Does, Jamie. Amazingly so.
Yeah, and I can't. None of us can. All of us can't wait to see.
We're
this
trying
thing,
to get to see it as soon as possible. If we could see it right now, hang out in the editing suite or whatever.
Yeah. Which brings us to our first guest. The Movie Geeks are honored to bring to the program one of our most profoundly talented actors. Toby Jones has worked on stage and screen for quite some time. In fact, in 2001, he starred in the London West End comedy Kenneth Branagh directed, the play What I Wrote, which earned him the Olivier Award for Best Actor in a Supporting Role, as well as a Tony Award nomination when it transferred here to Broadway. Earlier films include The Messenger, Finding Neverland, Miss Henderson Presents Elizabeth I, and of course his voice work as Dobby in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Mm-hmm. But it was his searing portrayal of Truman Capote in 2006's brilliant film Infamous, which set his career in high gear, resulting in a continued string of unforgettable performances in films like The Painted Veil and The Mist. This year he graces the screen with three more incredible works in City of Ember, as Karl Rove in Oliver Stone's George Bush film W, and his legendary Hollywood maverick Swifty Lazar in Ron Howard's Frost Nixon. I had the great delight of speaking with Mr. Jones early this morning as he called in from his home in London, and it was a bit early for me. So if my voice sounds a little softer than usual, that's why. And also, I must say, it sounds sexier than usual, too, when I wake up first thing in the morning. So you'll notice my come-hither voice. It's very appealing.
There you go. That's all we needed to know.
Yeah, this is a tremendous conversation with a terrifically generous and talented actor. Here's our conversation with Mr. Toby Jones.
I have to tell you that whenever someone asks me for my favorite actors, you're always on the top of the list. So I
especially to me. I bet you say that to all your pod guests.
That's not true at all. No, no. I'm very taken by your work, so I appreciate you being on.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Now, I'm looking at your release schedule. It's City of Ember, October 10th.
Yeah.
W, October 17th. Frosty Nixon in December. You're really owning the multiplexes this season.
I don't know about the multiplex. Do you think all of those will be multiplex films?
Well, I think that a couple of those definitely have that potential. They're all such high quality films with great filmmakers behind them.
I mean, that is the real, for me, that's the most extraordinary thing, is the thrill of working with those three directors in their different ways is so remarkable. And as a British actor, to go over to the States, certainly in the case of Frost Nixon and W, and work with people whose films you've grown up watching, it's a fantastic thing.
Well, something strikes me about you, and maybe I'm off base, but these are such wonderfully challenging, risky roles that you've taken on. You have your whole career. But I think the thing that impresses me most about you are those choices, but it seems to me that you gravitate towards the material that frightens you the most. And I'm wondering how fear benefits you as an actor, if that is the case.
On a very practical level, fear keeps you awake at night, so you get more time to work on roles. Because you can't leave, if you're working on a voice or if you're working just to research, right, so you know what on earth you're talking about. But joking aside, when you're an actor, if you're not playing lead roles all the time, then it's quite chaotic, your life. You're thinking, what's on the table? What am I going up for? What may I get? What might I not get? And it's quite chaotic. I would say that, given the choice between two parts, if two parts came up simultaneously, I would certainly pick the other one because as an actor, you're trying to stay a moving target. You're not really trying to confirm what people already know about you.
Yes,
because I've never really understood people who want to do just one thing. But of course, it's a hard thing to do because people begin to associate you with certain parts. I just had the call before I spoke to you, I just had a call about a part, an American part, to do on radio here, which I love. Mm-hmm. And they said, we can't think of anyone else who could do it but you, and please do it. And which is incredibly flattering, and I suppose that is the aim, I suppose, is to try and play a wide variety of parts as possible.
Well, and the roles you have chosen, some of these roles are so iconic, and so I would think doing them as well as you do, it would be easy to be pigeonholed as one or the other if you weren't so versatile in your choices. But I'm thinking, of course, of Capote in Infamous, which
yeah.
I think is an extraordinary performance and the most extraordinary film that year.
You loved the film.
I adored the film.
Yeah, I have to say to you, Jeremy, that I think, you know, everyone always tries to sympathize with me, but, you know, it's very, very rare that a script that good will come your way, and the fact you get to act in it outweighs any kind of people feel a need to commiserate. But that's only because people didn't see it on the opening weekend. That gradually a film permeates the culture in a way that didn't used to happen.
Right.
And I think that that film has found a very wide, enthusiastic audience. I know it has, and I'm very pleased with that, because I just thought when I first read that script, it was so good that I'd never have a chance to play that part.
I think this story is bigger than an article. I think it's a book.
I can see that. But nonfiction, right?
Yes, of course it will all be true, but...
But what? Either it is or it isn't.
You're not understanding. I want to bring fictional techniques to a nonfiction story.
What fictional techniques? The ones where you make stuff up?
Excuse me, if I were going to make stuff up, do you think I'd bother taking all these notes?
Well, you're obviously planning to turn Bonnie Clutter into some faux poetic recluse when what it sounds like is that she was just thrown off by her menopause.
What is your stupid point?
That you shouldn't be doing what you're doing. The truth is enough.
I must say, I don't appreciate this lecture from you, of all people. Mockingbird was based on true things, and you sure improved that.
Right. It's a novel. Reportage means recreating, not creating.
This is a new kind of reportage.
Oh, and the way you play it and the way it is written, the part has so many colors to it.
And
the film is lively and deeply sad, and it's an amazing experience. But also, you know, Karl Rove in the upcoming W, and Swifty Lazar and Frost Nixon, and these real-life kind of iconic characters. I'm wondering what your process is in crafting these. Are they essentially the same when you're tackling a role such as these?
I suppose a process has emerged just because of those recently playing people who are actually either alive or certainly died relatively recently. I suppose, you know, you try and watch as much footage of them as you can. And in the case of Capote, there was a lot of footage, interview footage. And in the case of Karl Rove, you have the extraordinary thing of finishing a day's film and going home and watching him live on TV, which is slightly strange. And then with Swifty Lazar, it's slightly different because it's very, very hard to get any footage of him. And so working with his voice, I got access to some CDs of his voice dictating stuff, which is really useful. So it varies, but how one does it, I think there's a certain amount of research that goes in of reading what people would imagine goes into researching a part, and then there's a kind of intuitive thing that has to take over, because you just don't know how people pick up the phone or redial numbers or sit alone in their hotel bedroom or finish their meal or get up. There's just no way of doing that, and I think that's when using one's imagination, you try and piece together something. And on good screenplays, which all the ones I've mentioned are, they suggest a dynamic that you're sort of trying to either work with or work against to suggest character in it.
Yeah, there's many examples of this, but the one that comes to mind is, I remember hearing an interview with De Niro years back when he was preparing Cape Fear, and he said that he started to find the character when he started to try on those really garish Hawaiian shirts. I was wondering, have you built any of these characters from the outside in?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, in general terms, I suppose I have, because that was the way I was trained, which is I was trained a lot in movement, and so I suppose I'm drawn to try and find the way people move, mm-hmm. but moving in the widest sense, because, of course, their voice is movement as well, and has to be to try and link the voice to the body so that you're not just doing a voice and then doing everything else, but trying to find out how the voice comes out of the body is the challenge, really, because otherwise I think it looks like you're trying to imitate someone, which you're not really. You're trying to actually create a character very heavily based on the person you're playing, you know.
Yeah. Is there kind of an aha moment for you when there's a adjustment or a phrase or something that you find where you know I've got it, this character?
Well, I mean, it depends slightly on the size of the part. Obviously, Truman Capote is by far the biggest role I've ever played on screen, and there are many aha moments when you're trying to work out why he might speak in that extraordinary way, and that's partly anatomical reasons, and also you're sort of thinking about the way he grew up and where he grew up. So that's a sort of longer process. But when you haven't got so much time, to a certain extent with Karl Rove and Swifty Lazar, there's a photo of Swifty Lazar. There's a story of Swifty Lazar as a young man, and he looks extraordinary. I mean, as an older man, he looks sort of... he's an extraordinary concoction of high fashion and wealth.
Yeah.
On this tiny man with these very famous spectacles.
Right.
But then you think he's going to be eccentric and wildly amusing and stuff. And I'm not sure that he is. I think what he is incredibly tough guy who fights to be taken seriously. And he started out his career as a music agent going from club to club, and there's actually a great story about him glassing Otto Preminger when there was some problem over the rights to In Cold Blood, and Swifty Lazar literally getting up from his table, he's a tiny man, smaller than Truman Capote, and clacking this enormous Otto Preminger with a glass, and that fighter thing, that sort of felt very important, because that's a useful thing to play against the kind of exotic eccentric dress that the guy doesn't get the joke, you know. And Karl Rove, I just always think Karl Rove, you know, I was struck, the first thing I ever thought about before I was even asked to play Karl Rove is it always looked like he's listening to a joke, you know, always somewhere that no matter what is thrown at him, no matter how much, you know, shit gets thrown at him, he always appears to be, I was saying somewhere that it's like he's getting circus music piped into, directly into his ear or something. Is it just a kind of, it's all a big game, and a game that he plays incredibly well, or has done up to now, and I'm not sure how ideological Karl Rove actually is deep down, fundamentally. I think he's fascinated by the whole game of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Rove, in that I hear actors speak about, even if they're playing the most villainous of parts, because even if you're playing the villain, you're the hero of your own story.
Yeah.
That you must have some level of sympathy or empathy for your characters, and I'm wondering where you found that in Rove.
Well, I think, you know, I think you're right the way you put it. The thing is, everyone's trying to do the best they can in life, and some people forget that the strategies that they're using to be the best that they can at whatever it is they're doing have. You know, they don't coincide with what other people are doing, and also that what they've done that may not work anymore for a different situation.
Right.
And I think that Karl Rove had a very strange childhood. You know, he lost his parents divorced, and he became very close to his stepfather, who then moved away, and I don't mean his stepfather, I mean his, the second father. So there's turbulence there, you know, there's a lot of turbulence there, and from what you hear about it, he's sort of monstrously controlling of his staff, and this need to control, this need to be in charge, this need to be at the center of the universe. These are things that are neither good nor bad, they're just ways people are coping with the world, and they're in a way much more interesting and useful for an actor than any judgment about whether people are, you know, how good or bad society views them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really not my job as an actor to do that. It's the job of the writer, first of all, to put you in situations.
Sure.
And in oftentimes, the most interesting thing would be to play against that, you know, to play against the badness of a situation or play against the goodness of a situation.
Well, I'm a huge fan, as we all are, with the work of Oliver Stone, and with this film and so many of his other films, I think this is where he thrives. It feels like this movie is in kind of a dangerous area. It's right there on the edge, and I'm wondering.
Yeah, he seems to absolutely love that. Yeah,
I'm wondering if you felt that as an actor.
Yeah, I felt that he was. He's a very inspirational director. He's his energy and his refusal to take the easy option, even when budgetary demands are put upon him, is very inspiring. It's the kind of thing you want to be around, that kind of energy. And his, you know, people have talked about it, but maybe it's not so widely known about just how much information he has in his head about history, both recent political history and ancient political history. He has sort of direct access to this. And so when he's strutting around a film set and coming in whispering in your ear and directing things, he has that film director's skill of being able to listen to many different voices in his head simultaneously. But one of those voices is this political historical knowledge, and he's able to cite things, you know, almost at will, instances of things. That's amazing. I mean, it's really astonishing.
Is it possible, because I know you do your fair share of stage work as well, is it possible to have that kind of sense of freedom on a film set that you do on a theater stage?
Well, you're never going to have control of time in a way that you do on stage. The thrill for the actor on stage is that you're in charge of controlling the time. And obviously, the director and the editor and to some extent film executives are the eventual deciders of time. But if you have a director like Oliver Stone, I suppose, or indeed Doug McGrath on Infamous, who wants to tell a story with, just, you know, they want to use extravagant, flamboyant characters to tell a story that may look realist but requires, you know, great dynamics in the performance, you're going to get freedom of performance, you know. And in fact, both those directors pushed me to go further in my characterization than my instincts for acting on film, you know, first suggested.
I mean, I know that the approach of this film is satirical in a way.
Have you seen it?
Not as of yet, no, sir.
No. I haven't seen the film yet. But what's interesting about the whole satirical thing is I think that people may be expecting a ha-ha ride. And there's two things I would imagine I'm going to see when I see this film. And the first one is that I don't think people are going to come out and go, God, George Bush, what an idiot. I think they will think certainly big aspects of what decisions he's made will be based on a limited understanding of problems. Or an understanding that is conditioned by more personal things, a bit like we've been talking about the other characters. I think that much of the film is about his struggle to escape the shadow of his past. And that's a very serious theme, and I think it's treated seriously. Nonetheless, he's, for all his extraordinary memory, George W. Bush, he's not a great analyst. He says in the film he's a gut player, and I think that it would be weird not to laugh at some of the, laugh very darkly, because we're all suffering the consequences of his limited understanding. But what's interesting is, which I like in any film, is the complicated tone of it, really.
And I think that Stone embraces that. His Nixon painted a brilliant man with just tremendous demons, and I thought it was very, very sympathetic.
Me too.
I think that's a big strength of Oliver Stone's that people refuse to point out. Tell me, the one film that we haven't discussed is City of Ember, and that opens up on October 10th. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Well, that one, I went to meet the director for that, Gil Keenan, who's clearly a genius. It didn't take very long to realize he was a genius, because he lifted out and showed me some pictures and stuff like that, and I'd read the script, and it's not the most demanding part I've ever played. It allows me to act with Bill Murray, which is great thrill. But what's very exciting about it, I think, is the world that Gil has created in the film, which is a sort of Gilliam-esque world.
Mm-hmm.
It's a world for fans of people like Terry Gilliam, who make microcosms, who make fantasy films that aren't not a whole new set of rules so much as a kind of comment on the rules we're already almost living by.
Mm.
And it's just visually very, very beautiful and very, very daring for a studio to make a film like this for children, because it's very dark for children, which is one of the great things about the book, but also it's just, it's a very interesting cast, in it, very diverse cast in it. And again, it's a dark theme for kids, it's an adventure of someone underground trying to escape back into the real world, which they've been told is destroyed,
It looks fascinating. I was
fascinated. Yeah.
I knew that I just had to see what that film was when I saw that trailer. You come from a family of performers. It's kind of acting seems to be in your blood in a way. I know your father.
Yeah.
He's in one of my favorite films, which is Wild at Heart.
Yes.
Did you catch that early from them?
It's hard to get immunization from those things. My dad's a pretty private man, a pretty shy man, and when he works, he works. When he comes home, he comes home. He doesn't live by a swimming pool in L.A. waiting for the phone to ring. He lives a very quiet life, and like a lot of actors. So I don't think I got seduced by any glamour of it. I think I was very aware of the excitement of certain jobs taking you across the world to meet extraordinary people. I mean, that's the great privilege of our job is that we get to work with people who have fought very hard to be where they are in the industry, and who are kind of incredibly intelligent, fascinating people, whether they're makeup artists, special effects people, editors, or cameramen, or even, grips and people like that, who have worked in a lot of very strange places doing strange things. And I think that both he and I share a love of meeting those people. And I think that sense of adventure I got quite early, definitely.
Well, these three films this season look fantastic, and I'm
Thank
sure
you.
You're going to. I appreciate your talent and your generosity so much. Thank you.
Thanks,
so
Jamie.
Much,
good luck.
All right, that was our exclusive interview with Mr. Toby Jones.
Great job, very good job.
Thank you, buddy. He was really delightful. Parts that I cut out of there, his fire alarm when went off in the middle of the interview. I suppose he was sitting at home, and his fire alarm went off. It was one of those moments where it was pre-recorded, so we were safe.
Right, right.
Yeah, but an incredible talent. And I just infamous. I suppose it is finding a new audience now, thanks to cable and DVD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good film. It's a shame that it came after Capote. Now I like Capote. I mean, I like his, like, I guess Philip Seymour Hoffman's and Catherine Keener's performance in Capote, but I have to say I think Infamous is the more interesting film.
Just like I said in the interview, for me, Infamous is such it's a revelation just because it's so much more of a colorful movie. It has so much more color in it.
Yes.
You know what? Truman Capote, obviously he dealt with a great deal of struggle, particularly following In Cold Blood.
Mm-hmm.
But he was lively. He was was the liveliest one in the room. He was the raconteur, the one that everyone you know, went to, gravitated towards.
Right.
You really got that sense in Toby Jones' performance that and the effect that this had on him was motivated, and the relationship between he and forgive me, I can't remember the character's name, but Daniel Craig played.
Yeah, he was, and Daniel Craig is wonderful in that, and Sandra Bullock is wonderful.
They're all fantastic.
Yeah, and
but that relationship, Weaver. That relationship was developed in a way where I understood it. I felt it.
I agree with you 100% about that. It was a fascinating film.
And you know, it strikes the perfect note from the very first scene, if you remember. Gwyneth Paltrow, everyone's dining and talking and having a great old time. This is a life of facade.
Mm-hmm.
And Gwyneth Paltrow, this very sultry-looking, gorgeous singer, walks up and starts to sing a song, and then she becomes so moved that she stops.
Right.
And all activity and all that surface in the restaurant stops.
Right.
That brief moment. And that's... that sets the tone for the film. That's really what the film is.
Right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I'm crazy about that movie, and I'm crazy about him. And it was just a tremendous treat to have him on the show. So, got an advanced look at W, so a little bit more of an understanding of that now. And now it's on to our next segment.
Now, they say Minnesota Fats is the best in the country out where I come from. Is that a fact?
Yes, sir, boy. They say that old fast just shoots the eyes right off them balls.
You a hustler, Ames? Come on, Ames. Look.
You a hustler?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I guess I'm pretty tough to deal with, huh? Hard case. Yeah. I guess I gotta find my own way.
If we are to have faith in justice, we need only to believe in ourselves.
Paul Newman passed away this weekend. He was 83 years old. An enormously fulfilled life by any accounts. I mean, I wanted this to be more of a celebration, as everyone that has spoken of Paul Newman, who worked with him or knew him, that's the tone that they take, because his life meant something to so many people.
You're right.
And Jerry, I was speaking to you in that, obviously, just an exceptionally gifted actor. He made it look effortless. He was just one of those guys.
He did.
But I cannot separate the actor from the humanitarian. And I was saying to you, usually when someone passes, they say he was best known for blah, 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 for this role or that role. Paul Newman is known by so many people for so many different things.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, as movie fans, he affected our lives, just the quality of his work and his choices. But so many other lives were changed in such profound ways and enriched
charity
from the philanthropic work that he did.
Mm-hmm. The Newman's Own stuff, like, was it $250 million to charity? I mean, that's incredible. Unheard of. He was just selfless in so many ways.
And very modest, too.
Incredibly
about
modest.
About all things. I mean, he was proud of his accomplishments, but embarrassed by taking credit for them, it seemed. In terms of his acting, I saw the Inside the Actors Studio episode that he was a part of. He was the very first guest on that program, actually. He never considered himself... it wasn't an easy road for him.
he wanted to be a jock, and yet he was not good at any of the sports he attempted. He fell into acting. He thought it was really something he had to work for. He didn't feel like he had a natural knack for it at all.
Right.
Which is shocking, seeing his work.
I can't accept that, but okay. Or I have a lot of trouble accepting that he would think that.
I think the Actor Studio aired somewhere, maybe 96, something like that. And he said, I feel like I'm just getting there now. When it comes to it being easier, an easier road for him. He said he couldn't watch his early performances. But let's start to talk about some of these performances. The thing that strikes me, the first movie that I saw him in, it was in junior high school when I was just getting into films, was HUD. And what struck me about HUD was that here was clearly a leading actor, handsome charm, effortless ability, and he wasn't afraid to play a louse.
Yeah, no, he is. I saw it a couple years ago in a revival in Los Angeles, and you're absolutely right.
A real daring film. What are some of these early, and of course before that we had Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and
yes,
Cat Hustler.
On a Hot Tin Roof is one that stands out. HUD is really the one that I keep going back to lately, especially since I saw it on the big screen. Now, I have to tell you, growing up, what I remember in, like, elementary school is watching Exodus on TV, and later on he made it to Towering Inferno, but I remember watching that when it came on television for the first time, and I saw it in the theaters. What did we see? Absence of Malice. I know that's later on, but I remember seeing that in the theater when it came out.
No, you're absolutely right. In Absence of Malice, it feels kind of like a... I think this is unfair because I think it's like a great fast read of a novel, that film.
Mm-hmm.
It seems maybe a bit sterile, but his performance is sturdy. I mean, it's just, it anchors the movie as he did in so many of his movies. The Sting, of course.
No, definitely.
Yeah, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Mm-hmm.
Cool Hand Luke.
The Hustler.
The Hustler, yeah.
I mean, all of these are just great. And the Long Hot Summer. I mean, there's stuff I remember when Bravo used to be good. I know that's
right.
A long time ago. But when
Bravo
used to be good, we would watch, and then AMC used to be good. Now, that's a very long time ago. Like movies like From the Terrace, I remember watching. The Young Philadelphians. This is like in the early 90s. These movies would come on cable, and I remember watching them, because I did not know these movies growing up, and, you know, watching a very young Paul Newman, and he's just superb, incredible in some of these early films, unbelievable.
Yeah, and these films are incredible, and he, in terms of personal tastes, he really enjoyed Slapshot.
That's a great one. The Hanson Brothers, yes.
Yeah, he loved that film. But his favorite performance of his own, if I understand correctly, was City Limits, The Verdict.
And that is your favorite?
That is my favorite, Paul Newman. And outside of Dog Day, possibly Network, it's my favorite Lumet.
And I watched
film.
That again. This in June, I rented that and watched it again. A superb movie.
Yes, it is, and a real investment by Paul Newman in that film. Not to say that he wasn't invested in his previous performances, but this is a Paul Newman that's shattered. His soul and his spirit is shattered, and he's just so desperately trying to recapture it.
Right.
And just little touches in his performances, like when his hands are shaking too badly to pick up the drink, and so he kneels down with his mouth and sips it, and just great, great moment, little character moments that just enrich the scene so much. that aren't necessarily scripted. He brings life to it. And I love him in that movie, reading Mamet's dialogue, working with Jack Warden.
Mm-hmm.
They worked so well together.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. He goes in there. There's something about the Paul Newman persona. Clearly a handsome man, he always was. Clearly movie star looks. But he never tried to deny that. He never tried to deny himself of that. Like you read about it, and this isn't to put anything on Brad Pitt, but you read about Brad Pitt and how he almost resents, in terms of career, his pretty boy image for the longest time and worked so hard to go against that. You never got that sense of Paul Newman, but there was a wink in his performances, you know.
You see that. You see that in some of the, you know, a movie that I like a lot. I don't know if we've ever talked about a movie I saw. I remember I actually saw it because I was waiting for we were waiting for the train in Vermont, of all places, and we went to go see Blaze.
Oh, yeah.
I love Blaze. I thought he was great in that. And I liked him in another movie made around that time, was Batman and Little Boy with John Cusack, I think, is in that. And
sure. That
was another good one I liked.
Yeah, Blaze is really, it's kind of the it's kind of the start of his old coots phase.
you're right. That's a good
Yeah, and he's brilliantly funny and eccentric in Blaze, and you could tell he's letting it loose. I mean, he's just having a great time.
Yeah, he does that in Nobody's Fool, too.
Yes.
Now, there's a movie I do like. Now, this movie was supposed to be, you know, he kept saying this is going to be my last movie. You know, there are a couple of times in the late 90s he did that. There is a movie that not a lot of people like that I like called Twilight. With him and James Garner, that I thought was pretty good. I know a lot of people don't like it.
Yeah, the Benton movie.
Yeah.
Listen to this cast. Paul Newman, Susan Sarandon, Gene Hackman, James Garner. A great pedigree that film had. I think I was expecting more.
I think a lot of people were expecting more. But I enjoyed it, I won't lie to you.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it when I saw it.
And he's won three. He won three Oscars, two of which were honorary.
Right.
One was for body of work. One was for his humanitarian efforts. And his acting Oscar was for The Color of Money, which really set up a kind of controversy, a movie geek controversy that we've heard many times since about certain actors.
Right.
You know, he should have won for this and that long before that, and you actually give it to him for The Color of Money. I think The Color of Money is a superb performance.
Scorsese, you should let Scorsese direct your sequel.
Yeah.
It's a lesson learned there. Let Scorsese direct your sequel. No, it's an excellent movie. I never understood why people had a problem, or the people did have a problem, why. It's a superb film.
Well, The Hustler is kind of classically constructed.
Mm-hmm.
It's the underdog too arrogant for his own good. He loses everything, but he's
mm-hmm.
He's determined to pick himself up again with that one last big game. It's going to be his comeback. Color of Money is different. Color of Money is that plus 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's mature. It's about a life of regret. It's about knowing when to throw in the towel and enjoy the other things in your life that don't involve competition.
Right.
Competition wears you out. I think it's a very mature work, and I think Newman is exceptional in it.
Oh, yeah.
But without that in mind, going in thinking, you know, The Hustler 2, it doesn't have that same adrenaline. It's not structured to have it.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't. I wouldn't look at it as Hustler 2, but I mean, yeah, there's some things you can say. I like how he has all of a sudden, like, the Jackie Gleason part, and Tom Cruise, you know, is obviously him in the first one, or wants to be him.
The Jackie Gleason part, but he's...
film.
But Fast Eddie Filson isn't so fast anymore. He's weird.
No, he's not. No, he's... That's why I think people... That's why I like it. I like when... It's a realistic
Yeah.
You know, he's not, you know, he's, it is, you know, everything catches up with you. And it's a very good movie.
I think it's something that's also in a different way, but similar to Infamous, in that I think people's appreciation of it has come by repeated viewings or
mm-hmm.
catching it years later. You start to appreciate it for what it is, and then you see the Tom Cruise's performance as a revelation.
It is.
He's phenomenal in that film.
Yes, he is.
He is so much Vincent, I think that's his name in that film. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And he is, like you spoke to just now, he really is Newman's character in The Hustler. He's all arrogance and...
It's a good film. And I'd like to say John Medina brought up in the chat room The Road to Perdition, and that's another, I think Paul Newman's excellent in that film. I think it's a good film, and it is underappreciated. There's no doubt about it.
I think so, too. And obviously he's playing a dark character in that one. And as we've stated, he never shied away from those dark characters.
Mm-hmm.
But you're with him because he's Paul Newman.
Yeah.
And pairing him up with Tom Hanks and another Daniel Craig performance in that film.
And another Daniel Craig, Jude Law, you know, a lot of great roles in that.
Conrad Hall, who had worked with Newman, I think, three times
mm-hmm.
and photographed brilliant stuff with him.
It's a very, I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but that was a very good movie. That's one you sadly don't hear a lot about. I know it's only, 6 years old, but that was a good film that a lot of people were, the big thing at the time was Tom Hanks was playing against type.
Right, right.
And that was the big deal back then.
Yeah. He was nominated again. Remember the year he was nominated again for Nobody's Fool. And that's the year.
That's a great movie. I love that movie.
It is a fantastic movie. I was talking to my dad the other night about Paul Newman, and I was listing off the great things that his life stood for. And
mm-hmm.
So married to Joan Woodward for 50 years, or married for 50 years, and Dad said, yeah, to the same woman. That's the point. Like Dad said, I've been married 50 years, but to three different women. So, and he also mentioned that Nobody's Fool is the one that he loves a lot. So, and Dad likes movies. He's just not a movie fanatic. But, that movie really... carries a lot of enjoyment for my father, too.
Well, no, that's good. And just for those that are interested, in today's New York Times, Maureen Dowell wrote a very nice appreciation in her op-ed column about Paul Newman that is definitely worth reading. So if you get a chance to go online or anything, or pick up a today's paper, it's definitely worth reading. It's a very nice article. The same as Stephen Hunter over the weekend in the Washington Post also wrote a beautiful tribute.
Yeah, and all of his co-stars are coming out with their tributes. I think Tom Cruise made a statement today, and Tom Hanks, and of course Robert Redford, who they were best friends.
Mm-hmm.
For so many years, and some similar actors in that you don't see them acting. So they were paired incredibly together. If we're looking at some of these other movies. The Hudsucker Proxy.
Yeah, that's another good one.
Sure.
Yeah.
He directed a couple of times. One of those films was Harry and Son that he did with Robbie Benson. I remember
I saw
that
on the plane.
I remember seeing that as a kid. I used to watch it a lot.
I remember when Robbie Benson was like, every woman loved him?
Yes.
I do remember. Everyone loved Robbie Benson. I don't know what happened to him, but everyone loved him.
I remember back when every woman loved me. That's just a memory now.
I missed out on that phase, so I don't know.
Fort Apache, The Bronx, which
I remember that, yeah.
Controversial kind of film. It was another one he did. He worked with Robert Altman. It's critically blasted, this film, Buffalo Bill and the Indians.
He also had Quintet, the science fiction one, a very strange science fiction film with Altman, too.
Right.
That was just I remember watching that a long time ago.
Drowning
Didn't he make
Pool?
Another film with Altman? Is that Buffalo Bill, another movie called Health? Or was he not in Health, I guess? I know that's an Altman film, but...
I'm not sure about that.
I don't think so. I think I'm wrong about that. But there's Quintet and Buffalo Bill. Yeah, those were both... I think Quintet was just ignored by everyone, but...
Right, right. The Drowning Pool and Harper.
Harper, I just watched a couple of years ago. Great movie.
Yeah. He worked with Hitchcock on Torn Curtain.
Mm-hmm.
So many classic films that he delivered to us. But I think that Newman's own brand will be around a long, long time and will continue to do great things for so many the disadvantaged people of the world. And his camps, too.
Oh, the camps are great. I mean, you were just talking about this. I mean, it's... You just don't see it that often, the generosity, the charity, you know, especially in the way, and I like that he got out of it. He got away from Hollywood at a very young age, and he went to go live in Connecticut. He just wanted to get away from it.
Right.
He just wanted to, thought it was all just phony baloney stuff.
He was just one of the residents there where he lived in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Just an incredibly nice, generous guy that would stop and talk to you, and, one of his last roles was Empire Falls, which was the French PC directed HBO film with Ed Harris and Helen Hunt and Aidan Quinn, on and on, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, on and on and on.
Yeah, everyone was in that. That was a really big deal when that came out.
Yeah, and then of course he did voice work for the Pixar film Cars. Mm-hmm. He also stayed on the stage as well. He did stage work. I think the last thing he did was probably Our Town for his little theater there in Connecticut. He did it on stage, and then he modulated his performance when they filmed it on TV. I think they shot it for Showtime. And he got great notices for that, too. I saw a Letterman clip. When Letterman went to CBS, his inaugural show, the first show he did at CBS, he was summoning the spirit of Ed Sullivan. Ed Sullivan came up in a little bubble, and Ed Sullivan said, "Now, terrific young actor, Mr. Paul Newman." And then out of Letterman's audience, up stands Paul Newman, and everybody goes crazy. And Paul Newman did this thing where he pointed people like he's holding a gun.
Right, right.
And he'd shoot at them, like, pew, pew. Like you're playing pistol, like couple
right.
of Indians with your finger.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I remember
that.
This. I do remember.
Yeah, yeah. He did that. I saw him do this. This was his greeting. That was his greeting. And the audience quieted down, and he said, "Where the hell are the singing cats?" And he said, Letterman said, no, this is the David Letterman show. He said, "Oh, I must be in the wrong theater." And he walked out. And Letterman said, "Only Paul Newman could do that thing with his gun, pew, 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 and say, 'Where the hell are the singing cats?' and just look like the coolest person on the planet."
Hey, look what happened when John McCain lied to him.
Right. Yeah.
You don't lie to Letterman. That's the one most important thing I've learned this year. Don't lie to Letterman.
Yeah, but Newman was... effortless on the screen and have that same kind of persona in his life. You just gravitated towards him.
Yeah.
Some people have that gift, and I'm sure that Newman was one of them. Some people have the gift of, no matter what status they are, they speak to you and you are the only person in the room. You know, they make you feel like they're only interested in you.
Mm-hmm.
They have genuine interest. And it's this very special gift, and it makes that person feel 10 feet taller for a moment, you know. And I think that Newman probably had that, by all accounts.
Oh, he was the genuine, he was the real deal. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
There's a big hole.
Yeah.
With
now, if we're talking to our listeners out there. And everyone listening live to us, we thank you so much for joining us tonight. And all the people in the chat room, welcome. And if you're listening, join the chat room. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, the chat room, we got a lot going on in there.
They're talking about Mr. Newman, and now they're on to Letterman, and a great conversation about Toby Jones earlier and the Oliver Stone filmography happening in there. But if you're wanting to recommend a film for our listeners to rent this week or this weekend to just bring out an appreciation of Paul Newman.
Let us know.
Which one would you choose? No,
I'm
asking you.
One that we're not talking about or one that you really like a lot that we did talk about.
Yeah, let us know that in the chat room, but I'm actually asking you, what would your recommendation be?
I would, you know, at first I would say HUD, because that's just like, but the other one, actually, that I'd really go for is because I haven't seen it in such a long time, and it's a good movie. I haven't seen it in, like, decades, but it's, I want you to see the one about Roy Bean, The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean.
Yeah.
It's the one that's supposed to be real. I mean, I've seen it, I saw it, but I haven't seen it. It's been on, like, my Netflix queue forever, and I've just been meaning to get around to watching it again. But that's, I remember watching that. That's a good one. And the other one that you can't go wrong with is Cool Hand Luke. You just can't go wrong with that.
That's true. The Life and Times of Roy Bean, that's a 1972 film. And that is spoken of with great relish by fans.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it, to be perfectly frank.
It's a long time, dude. I mean, it's like in the 80s, I guess. We're still talking VHS.
Yeah. And, of course, we mentioned The Towering Inferno. That's he did that in The Sting.
And The Towering Inferno was, like, talking about one of those great all-star cast. And Steve McQueen.
Act across from Steve McQueen, which is a great pairing.
Yes.
I don't know what I. It's difficult to say. One title.
Just go for. I think the one that is your favorite is always worthwhile watching.
Yeah, I think it's The Verdict.
It really is. It holds up very well. It's, that never goes out of style.
Yeah, it doesn't. But it's interesting to compare to some of his earlier work where he's essentially playing the rascal, you know, because there's no trace of that in The Verdict.
Right.
But it's definitely there in HUD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely there in HUD.
It's Butch Cassidy and those earlier films. But I would choose The Verdict just for the breadth of invention in the performance and just... He looks like he has the weight of the world on his shoulders in that film. And it's dramatically, it's so well crafted.
Mm-hmm.
We paid tribute to Sidney Lumet many months ago and just pointed out he's a true director in that he directs moment by moment. There's just moments in a scene that you relish that aren't contained in the script, but they're inspired by the material in the script. And they just deepen each scene. And there's moments of business with Paul Newman in that film that epitomize that.
You're absolutely right.
What are we doing in the chat room here? Well, we're still talking about that.
We're still talking about, well, then they got to let him in, but we're also talking, John mentioned a party. Okay. Patrick 8, Cat on the Hot Tin Roof. You're absolutely right. He is terrific there. Patrick, no doubt. He was incredible in the Tennessee Williams adaptations.
Yeah.
Electrifying.
And you think Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, he and Elizabeth Taylor, and you think about, when was Streetcar? What year did that come out?
Oh, Streetcar, let me get the exact date because I'm going to flub it, so...
Here we are. We have our trusted computers. And
yeah, isn't it amazing the age of the internet?
Yeah. Before, I'd have to actually pick up a book.
Yeah. All right. 1951.
And Cat on a Hot Tin Roof was 58. So it's a good time for Tennessee Williams adaptations.
Yeah.
And speaking of Tennessee Williams adaptations, another directorial effort of Paul Newman's was The Glass Menagerie. In which he cast Malkovich as Tom. I have a very special place in my heart for this play. Malkovich as Tom, Karen Allen as Laura, and playing the dominating mother is his wife, Joan Woodward, which was one of those roles that Joan Woodward was made to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She did it beautifully, and I recall other film versions of that play, most notably one with Katharine Hepburn, and it was more tailor-made to Joanne Woodward's particular gifts. And a very delicate piece and shot in the spirit of a theatrical performance almost. I mean, you don't mess with those words. You don't mess with that poetry. So it was all intact.
Mm-hmm.
And I know James Naughton, the actor that portrayed the gentleman caller, he and Newman were friends, and they've done several movies together. I think he is actually one on the board of directors or in a high administrative or executive position on his hole-in-the-wall kid camps for the disadvantaged children.
Right.
So he's maintaining a lot of the Newman legacy from here on out as well. So these are, I hope we gave you guys some great ideas about some movies to go out and pick up of Mr. Newman's.
I was thinking, though, and I know if he had lived, they couldn't do it, but he and Redford, they wanted to make another movie together.
Yeah.
But
They had it. They actually had, according to Redford, they had a lot of that script done.
Right.
And he said it was just so sad because Newman actually called him, I don't know how long ago, but recently, the past couple of years, and said, I got to retire, I can't do it anymore. His point was that he couldn't operate at his maximum,
right?
At least not to his satisfaction. He didn't want to coast, you know. He said it's just too much of a struggle now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember.
So,
yeah, it was heartbreaking.
And so he got out. But you know what? This is why it's such a life fulfilled. He probably said, well, it's, you know, not able to do it again. But so many more things to live for. His charity work, his passion for race car driving, which
the
we
race
haven't
car
even touched upon.
Right,
yeah.
I mean, it's something we really haven't touched on, but I really wanted to do that more than anything, I got the impression, sometimes,
right.
Because there's the gap in between movie, there is gaps, years, and I think he really, from what I gathered, he really, when he talked about race car driving, the enthusiasm, it was just all over the place. He loved it.
Well, like I mentioned before, he was a failed jock as a young man. Race car driving was the one thing that he felt at home in, he felt proficient at, and so it became a big passion of his. And he also told the story of he was going to go race car driving in competition. And his wife handed him his helmet, and with this very stern look,
mm-hmm.
said, "This is your last race. Yeah, this is your last race." And he came in first place. And this was you know, he's in his late 60s, early 70s with this.
Right.
And so he went to his trailer to his wife, and she said, never stop racing." She changed her tune. Just a man of many passions. He lived life to its fullest.
Mm,
we're waiting a call
from
the screenwriter Nick Anore's Infinite Playlist, Miss Lorene Scafaria, and I'm probably massacring the pronunciation of that name, as I normally do. I'm surprised I got Teddy Jones right.
The reviews for that have been nothing short of phenomenal from what I've read so far.
Through the roof.
It sounds like a winner. It sounds like they have a winner here. So.
Yeah, absolutely, and it comes out this Friday. Quite a few films come out this Friday.
Yeah, we have that. We have the one we're really looking forward to, the Bill Maher movie.
Right.
And we have Apollosa Expands. I don't think it's a nationwide. I think it's just slowly. I think it comes out in my neck of the woods on Friday. And we have Blindness comes out. We're not going to go there.
This is a bad taste, but I think it's funny.
Blind people are protesting the film.
Yes, and exactly. And you know what the argument usually is against people that protest movies. But you haven't even seen it.
Going to hell.
That takes out a very special irony here.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It's
terrible. It's funny. Come on.
It is funny. You know, no, it is funny. But what's? Oh my God. Maybe they should go see Beverly Hills Chihuahua then.
A
double feature
sure
of those
that.
Two films. There you go.
There's that. If Religious is just too much for you. Wash it down with a cup of Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
Starring Andy Garcia.
He does. Does he do a voice in that?
I think he does the main voice.
Does he?
God, from Vincent Mancini to that. But they're saying that's going to be like, there's no joke that this Beverly Hills Chihuahua could end up being, I think I read this in Entertainment Weekly, don't quote me on this, but like a sleeper hit of this season.
I believe it. I believe it. Andy Garcia's Chihuahua and Vincent Mancini to, you know, going from a dog to playing a dog. It's very interesting. No, I like Godfather 3.
I like that. You're not going to hear any complaints from me.
We just paid tribute to it last week.
I know.
But
I do want to give a shout-out to our home entertainment correspondent, Aaron, on Back by Midnight. I didn't get to hear the whole show, but I did think his interview with Talia Shire was wonderful. She seemed like a very cool, very nice person. And she had so much to say, and it was, and just hearing her viewpoint on the character in the third film, I thought was really nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a wonderful show. It also included cinematographer Gordon Willis, who's they call him the Prince of Darkness, and I think Aaron actually introduced him with that phrase. And
I didn't hear that.
No. He's known as the Prince of Darkness. I mean, that's common knowledge.
So is Robert Novak.
I just don't know how well he takes.
I don't know how I would take that.
What are you talking about, man? I'm a nice guy.
Yeah, it's really? Like, come on.
Alice Cooper's the Prince of Darkness. Davia, I always mispronounce his last name. I'm terrible at this, man. I'm terrible at this.
No, you're not. I mean, come on. Oh, stop it.
Terrific guest with tremendous insight. And our good friend Keith Hulick attended the last segment of the show defending Godfather 3. So look that up at Back by Midnight. It's a show here on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/back-by-midnight, spelled with a G-H-T. Thank you.
There you go.
Aren't I a great pitch person?
You're an awesome pitch person. Are you going to pitch Oscar?
No. No.
Okay. I just thought I'd ask. Yeah, we love Jason O'Brien. He's a good man. Very good man.
So far. He's not in the chat room this evening, Mr. O'Brien.
You know, he's out making it happen. You know, not. I mean, I can't always listen to his show. Sometimes when you guys are all of you are on together, I can't so I have to listen to the archive. He'll listen to the archive, right? He will listen to the archive.
Yeah, well, it's good stuff.
It is good stuff. He should be listening to the archive.
We're going to wait out another 7 minutes for our guest. It was interesting. I mean, I always share these things with our listeners. We booked her last week. I sent a reminder tonight, or actually earlier today I sent a reminder and didn't hear anything back. So maybe that was a sign that she's not available for tonight. I'm not sure. But it's been a great show, Paul Newman and Toby Jones.
Yeah, you can't do much better than that. And like I said, this movie, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, I got to say, they've been showing a lot of promos when we go to the movies for that. And it looks charming. It looks like sort of a teenage version of After Hours for the 21st century. Mm. I know that a lot of people would probably, if they heard that, would probably throw a rock at me. But that's what it looks like so far to me.
Yeah. And he actually gets papier-mâché'd in this one, too. So, Plaster of Paris or whatever.
There you go.
Michael Cera, he's something else, isn't he?
Yeah, with Superbad, Juno, Arrested Development. I mean, this guy's coming along. I mean, he's just cranking them out, and he's making a name for himself. Yeah. But I've heard that this, even though from the trailer, it sort of looks like he's playing the same character. In the reviews, they say this is definitely somewhat of a more mature character for him. And the futurist is searching for a rock. Thank you, my friend. That's really nice of you.
Well, I'll go ahead and read her introduction. By all accounts, it doesn't look like she's calling in this evening. So this gives you a sense of the movie and its appeal. Lisa Schwartzbaum at Entertainment Weekly
She gave it an A-, and she said, the marvelous, magical boy meets girl in the city that never sleeps romantic comedy, Nicanor's Infinite Playlist, is a revolutionary movie disguised as a familiar story. Yeah, that's high praise.
That is.
Let's play a trailer for it.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Let's do it. It's like a potpourri night on the Movie Geeks United.
This is Nick. He's a sensitive musician.
I'm not going. We have a gig, Nikki.
I don't want to go. I'm taking a mental health day.
Who's bad at relationships.
Hey, Tris, it's Nick.
I just wanted to talk to you. You know, I think we both said some things we didn't mean, like when you broke up with me on my B-day.
This is Nora.
Okay, everybody in.
She always plays by the rules.
You have to promise me that you won't get drunk tonight.
But tonight...
Nora! Alone again? I came here with someone.
Who?
She's going to break them.
Would you be my boyfriend for 5 minutes?
What?
Please, go in. Okay, great. Nick! Nora! How do you guys, like, know each other?
We're the same dentist.
Yeah, he's good.
Are you Tris's Nick?
I gotta get my friend at home.
We'll take the drunk mess home.
Yay!
You two go have fun.
If you touch one hair on her head, I will kill all of you.
Sorry, I'm being hairy.
Oh. Oh,
she'll be okay.
Are you off duty?
This isn't a cab.
Are you off duty?
Not a cab, my friend, I promise you.
I'm not a cab. I love you so much, it's retarded.
Okay, last stop.
What about him?
850. Charged a little extra for the cleanup.
The story lost the girl.
What? What?
Dark body!
Where are you?
I found Jesus.
What?
Jesus!
He's much taller in person. He's hung up on Tris.
Let's just say we're not the biggest fans of his ex, and we think you're the one.
Hey, Dave? You know the blow dryer?
Nora, come on.
Hey, what's wrong?
This doesn't concern you.
Push me again.
Oh, and what?
That's it. Awesome. Awesome night.
Oh, yeah!
Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
There it is. Trailer
two. It looks charming. It looks very charming.
So one of many choices at the multiplex this weekend. I still haven't seen Burn After Reading. I'm going to check that out, darn it.
It's good. You should check that out. And the other thing I think you should check out is Choke.
Choke, if it comes
I think Choke
now.
Is superb. The more I think about it, it doesn't hit you all at once, but the more I think about it, you and Chris are really the big champions of Sam Rockwell. And it's definitely, I think, one of like those things that he's just been leading up to doing. He's perfect in it.
Yeah. If it comes here, yeah, you got to remember where I live.
No, I understand.
The movie that I'm actually seeing this weekend, without a doubt, it's at our old movie house that's been here in town since the 30s, is Man on Wire. I'll finally be able to see that.
Oh, that's superb. Excellent film.
Which, interestingly enough, Gordon Willis mentioned last night on Aaron's show that was the last movie that he saw that really impressed him.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's a very effective film. I don't know much about this guy and what he did and everything, and for the obvious reasons, it's chilling, emotional to watch.
Now, I saw the movie Choke, but I don't think it's the movie you're talking about.
No. speaking of Choke, Jason O'Brien has just entered the chat room.
Wow.
Wow.
1 minute left.
It's
Jason
like
O'Brien
making that like out. Making that late, you know, heroic appearance, like John McCain at the Senate last week, crashing the cabinet meeting. There you go.
Right, and he just Jason O'Brien in perfect form just crashed our show. That is it for tonight.
we love Jason O'Brien. We love all of you, actually. Patrick, John Medina, The Futurist, Marinka, all of you. Tim Price, everyone who's joined us tonight, well-known, who I don't know, but and Aaron, who is known as Back by Midnight. In the chat room, Robin Walker, we are all grateful and thank you for so much for tuning in tonight.
And the many thousands that listen live and don't on archive, we thank you too. We're sharing the love. So much love to give. We talked about W, Jason, with
we
Mr. Toby Jones.
Shit, I missed it. Yes, you did.
Yeah, that tends to happen. You miss our lead guest when you tune in an hour and 15 minutes late. But you'll catch him on archive. It's a fantastic interview, and he talks a lot about Mr. Rove and about his experience on W. So, yes, Jason. I actually have people listen to my show.
That's my...
Thousands, that's right. That's right. More than I can count on my hand.
his
show.
Jason O'Brien, when Jason, all the hijinks ensue when Jason enters the show.
His show on Monday, we're listing, I'm taking part in that, we're listing our top five favorite Spike Lee films and the top five, our votes for the top five overrated films. I think there's going to be some lively discussion with my choices about the overrated films. I've read them to you this evening, so
yes,
I got to get my game face on for that show.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm very curious to hear Jason's.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of them he is Gone with the Wind. There, I gave it away. Gone with the Wind is one of them.
I can see where people would say that. I still think it's, you know, they're technically, there's just some stuff in there that you see people give, like Spielberg gives winks to that War of the Worlds of all movies.
Right. See the confrontation.
Yes, I see it. I see the last line.
Yeah. Has Orphans of the Storm reached Podunk? What is
Orphans
of the Storm?
Wait, is Orphans of the Storm is an episode of Brideshead Revisited, a TV series?
Oh.
But I don't think that's what he means, but that's one of the chapters of Brideshead Revisited, the British series, the British miniseries that...
This is Florida, so we get a lot of hurricane weather. I'm sure that kids have been orphans as a result. If that's what you mean, orphans of the storm. We've suffered that.
Whoa! Did you read? Oh, now Jason's being really nasty.
Yeah. Go. Just read over that.
I'm not. I'm gonna ignore it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Classic D.W. Griffith.
Okay.
Yeah. We don't get D.W. Griffith. We're still waiting. For. Did I read what?
Look, you're shameless. Oh, my.
Yeah, did I read what? You said something, you started to say something.
No, I didn't. No. I was just looking, okay, because I was, all right, D.W., I don't think you guys are getting D.W. Griffith. I'd be really surprised.
All right.
Look at the chat room is just... I think the futurist might have stated the truth right there.
Jason, you killed the show, the futurist says. All right, we'll see you guys on Sunday where we will welcome the screenwriter of An American Carol. Hopefully the screenwriter will call in. And the director of a new documentary on DVD called Larry Flint, The Right to be Left Alone. It's great. It's a great eye-opening documentary. And it's going to be a show of definite...
it's going to be both ends of the political spectrum for you, folks.
It's going to be pretty great. Yeah,
yeah, it will be.
We'll see you guys. And if whatever new movies that we see this weekend, Jerry,
we'll try to talk about. Yes, we'll definitely... I will see as much as I can before the show starts.
Yes. You'll cram.
I'm going to cram like crazy. Watch, I'll probably my car will break down probably.
The debate tomorrow night, as everyone knows, I'm sure everybody will be tuned into it. So, let's hope for some fireworks.
We're hoping for fireworks, and maybe Jason O'Brien will be on the debate too.
Well, yeah. Well, that'll kind of kill the debate like it does my show. All right. We will see you guys Sunday night. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.